From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
This morning when you came in my room, I was practically naked and you didn't look at my body once.
Today, actress Allison Janney. She's nominated for an Emmy for her performance in the series Masters of Sex as a woman just figuring out that her husband is gay. She's also nominated for an Emmy for her performance in the sitcom Mom. Janney is famous for her role as White House Press Secretary C.J. Craig on The West Wing.
Have you ever lied about the president's health?
Should I have my lawyer here?
I'm your lawyer.
You're the president's lawyer.
I'm the White House counsel, CJ. Have you ever lied about the president's health?
Also, TV critic David Bianculli talks about the history of broadcast talent competitions dating back to the radio show which helped launch Frank Sinatra's career. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the band Spoon. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Emmy Awards ceremony is coming up soon, August 25th. My guest, Allison Janney, is nominated for 2 Emmys, Outstanding Guest Actress in a Drama Series for her performance in Showtime's Masters of Sex, and Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series for her role in CBS's Mom. She won 4 Emmys for her performance on The West Wing as White House Press Secretary C.J. Craig. Janney's been in many movies, including Primary Colors, American Beauty, Juno, and The Help. Let's start with a scene from Masters of Sex, which is based on the story of William Masters and Virginia Johnson and the research they conducted into human sexuality starting in the late 1950s. Janney plays Margaret Scully, who's married to Barton Scully, the provost at Washington University Hospital, where he supervises Masters' research. Margaret is frustrated that her husband shows no sexual interest in her. She's just learned that he's been seeing prostitutes, but she hasn't figured out that those prostitutes are men, and her husband is deep in the closet. Here they are at a drive-in movie. Her husband is played by Beau Bridges.
We didn't have drive-ins in our day.
We didn't need them. We were married when we first slept together.
We were of our time.
That's not why we waited. Burton. I have spent the day racking my brains, pacing, wondering. Maybe I should light his clothes on fire. Maybe I should drive his car into the pool. Maybe I should tell him all about the man I've been seeing, who, by the way, wanted me in his bed, though he didn't love me. I don't say this to punish you, although God knows you deserve to be punished. I mean, prostitutes? That is so insulting to me and so far beneath you.
I will never do it again, ever. I swear to you.
Even if you never laid a hand on a hooker again, that wouldn't change what is so impossible to understand. This morning, when you came in my room, I was practically naked, and you didn't look at my body once. Not once. And yet your face was filled with such love.
Because I love you. You know that.
We didn't sleep together before we were married because you weren't interested in sleeping with me. And I excused it away by saying passion is for teenagers and nymphomaniacs. Passion is not what makes a good marriage. This is a perfect, beautiful man who loves me, who doesn't care that I'm tall and athletic, who doesn't want me to act stupider than I am. This is a man who understands me.
And 30 years later, we're still the best of friends. How many people can say that?
It's not enough.
Allison Janney, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your 2 Emmy nominations.
Thank you, Terry.
I feel so bad for your character in her marriage, which is unfulfilled because her husband is so deep in the closet. They're both victims of the repression of homosexuality. You must find this character so interesting.
She was incredibly fascinating to play. One of my favorite in my career so far because of the different layers that are at work in every scene and how long it takes for her to really, she keeps getting fed lies more, you know, the closer she gets to the truth, more lies are flung at her until she, you know, finally is faced with the real truth of why her marriage isn't working.
She wants to participate in one of the Masters and Johnson's sex research studies. And then they're asking her all these questions about orgasm and what she experiences during sex. And what she experiences is pure tension, not like the release of... the orgasmic release of tension. And
she seems so clueless about it.
Yeah.
I know. She gets asked, is there any release? And she said, oh, tremendous relief.
You know, yes,
she mishears the words.
Yes.
She's so glad when it's over. She doesn't understand. You know, she can't understand what they're getting at. She wants to say the right answers, of course, because she wants to be in the study. And then to realize in that moment in front of her husband's, you know, coworker that she's has never even had an orgasm before.
So what did you do to put yourself in the mindset of somebody who came of age sexually in an earlier time? didn't really understand her own capacity for sexual feeling, didn't understand what she was missing, didn't understand all the clues that her husband was a deeply closeted gay man. So, like, we're dealing in terms of sexual orientation and sex itself in another era. How did you go there?
I thought about my mother a lot and how she and my father got married at a really early age, at early 20s, and I don't think they probably had slept with other people before, you know, getting married. And just, you know, knowing my mother so well and how she is such a graceful woman who's very concerned with manners. And of course, I grew up, Episcopalian and very, you know, we don't really talk about personal things. You know, I remember my mother talking to me about the birds and the bees. Of course, I had already known, you know, probably years before she came to me. But the way watching her, remembering the way she talked to me about it, just everything about her reminds me of Margaret Scully.
What? How did she bring it up with you?
You know, she just started in this very slow, laborious kind of, just so I could tell how uncomfortable it was for her. And I was just as uncomfortable hearing my mother start to tell me about it when I already knew. And I think I even said, Mom, it's okay. I know. I've seen dirty magazines, or I've seen whatever.
Was she relieved or appalled?
I think she was a little appalled and a little like, well, my goodness, you know, she just... she was a little alarmed with me, as I've continued to alarm her. Even when I told her I was doing a show called Masters of Sex, before she knew what it was, she had a very hard time telling her friends in Dayton, Ohio that what's your daughter up to? And my mom would be like, well, she's doing a show called Mom. And then there's another show that's Bo Bridges is in it with her. And I'm not sure what it's called, but, you know, and now, of course, she's very proud of the show once she knew, you know, that it was actually a very real show and a very respected show.
So since there is so much frank sexual talk on the show itself, do people end up making sexual confessions to each other on the set while killing time before the next scene is shot, just to kind of get in the spirit?
Yeah, it does kind of make for the situation is so awkward that you do have to become fast friends, or you look for anything to be comfortable with your scene partner. And maybe that's, you know, sharing some silly thing that happened with you in bed, you know, your first time or whatever, just anything to break the ice. And I was not afraid to ask for, I had to ask for just a little shot of courage before I had my first sex scene with Teddy Sears, who was just the most gorgeous, wonderful, handsome specimen of
man. This is the younger man who you have an affair with.
The young man who... Yes.
You're not getting anywhere with your husband.
I'm not getting anywhere with my husband, and I decide I'm going to, you know, and he falls into my lap, so to speak, and I sort of go there, and it's wonderful for the audience to see Margaret Scully have her first orgasm on, you know, not so much for my mother on television, but, oh, my God.
Did you need a shot of courage for the scene or a shot of liquor?
Well, that's what I mean when I say courage.
Okay,
when I say courage, just a little shot of bourbon. I didn't know what they had. I just asked, you know, for something. And
yeah, whatever.
I just wanted something to just take the edge off, because I was beyond nervous. Who gets to do a sex scene when you're, you know, 50, whatever? You know, no one really gets to, not too many women get to do that. So, the worst part is, I think, doing the run-through for the crew when they come in. And you have a private rehearsal, and they're very great on Masters of Sex to keep the set very private and respect everyone. And you sort of go through the numbers with the director. And then they invite the crew in because they have to see it in order to, you know, boom it and light it and do it. And that's the part that just feels so weird. You know, I was like, can we just go by the numbers here and show them? The director's like, no, you got to show them what the action is so they know what, you know, is... I'm like, okay, all right, here we go. You know, you try to make fun of it and just dive in.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alison Janney. She's nominated for 2 Emmys, one for her performance in the Showtime series Masters of Sex, the other for her performance in the CBS sitcom Mom. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Allison Janney. She's nominated for 2 Emmys, one for her performance in the Showtime series Masters of Sex, the other for her performance in the CBS sitcom Mom. You know, it's interesting that as you're doing Masters of Sex, which is based on the real work that Masters and Johnson did in sex research, and that's a drama, and you're also in a sitcom called Mom, which deals a lot with sexuality, too, but it's a much more sitcom-ish approach.
Yes.
And must be so hard to transfer from, like, one mindset to the other?
I thought it would be, Terry, because I got cast in Mom, and I knew I was going to be doing that pilot in March of last year or somewhere in there. And then I was asked to be part of Masters of Sex and started filming that in February. So I did a couple of episodes of Masters of Sex before I went to film the pilot of Mom. And I was like, gee, this is going to be interesting. But once I got on the set of Mom and got in on those sets and had the scripts in my hand and started working on the material, I was kind of grateful that they were so different from each other, the characters. Bonnie Plunkett is the exact opposite of Margaret Scully in every way, and so I think if they had been closer in character, it might have been a little trickier. But I was so grateful for it.
Why don't we hear a scene from Mom? And this is the episode that earned you the Emmy nomination. It's a CBS series produced by the team who did 2 and a Half Men. And you play Bonnie, the single mother of a now adult daughter who's played by Anna Faris. And you've done a lot of drinking and partying and sleeping around over the years. But you very recently got sober and you're trying to improve your relationship with your daughter. Now, your daughter has also had alcohol and drug problems and she only recently got sober. She's the mother of 2 children, both out of wedlock, and she gave birth to her oldest when she was a teenager. Now that daughter is pregnant herself. But in this scene, you call your daughter in the middle of the night with some upsetting news.
Hello?
Are you awake?
At 2:30 in the morning? You betcha.
I think I'm pregnant.
Oh, God, can I not be awake? How is that even possible?
What kind of question is that? I happen to be in the bloom of my life.
Half the men in Napa Valley have been in the bloom of your life.
What?
Nothing. Did you take a test?
I don't need to. I've got all the signs. I missed my period. I'm moody. My nipples are incredibly angry. Trust me, there's fruit in these loins.
So as we heard in that clip, there's a lot of laughter in the series. And in the scene that we heard, though, it was like laughter after every single line.
I know.
And is that all laughter from the audience? Is there a laugh track, too? Is the laughter sweetened?
Well, I know. Some people, it's amazing, but they're really, the live audience is there, and they are laughing after every single line, and it's a... It's and you have to hold. You have to, like you do on the stage in live theater, you have to hold for the laugh. And then when we don't get a laugh on a line, that usually after the take, there'll be a big pause and the writers will be furiously thinking of new lines and they come up with floor pitches, is what they call them. And then they come in with notepads and tell us how to, now say this time, now say this time. And then they do the take again. And then if the audience laughs, we move on. If they don't, they keep writing. And it's kind of a crazy night, the tape night with the audience there. But those are all real laughs. And as to whether or not they use mix the laughs with other laughter, I don't really know. But I know that I'm there and I hear the audience laughing with us. So
what happens if you have to do a second take and the audience has already heard the joke? Are they going to laugh again?
Well, that's kind of interesting. They do have a stand-up comedian who's in the audience, keeping the audience warmed up and keeping them interested in between takes when the writers are off writing and there's like a lot of, you know, waiting around. He'll, you know, do magic tricks and ask the audience to, you know, sing and do karaoke. They do. I don't even. There's so many crazy things the stand-up does with the audience, and they always have a great time. But he always says, "Now remember, this is the first time you're seeing the scene, so you know, forget what you saw before and pretend this is the first." So he's always sort of coaching them on how to be a good audience. So so they're instructed on pretending like they haven't seen it before, and a lot of times with the new lines, it's like they haven't seen it before. So It's always just in the moment laughter.
In the series, Mom, your character goes to 12-step meetings because she's a recovering alcoholic and mm-hmm. is only recently sober. I know that your younger brother committed suicide, and I believe he had been, that he had had a drinking problem. And so I'm wondering what it's like for you to treat alcoholism in the kind of lighthearted way that the series does after seeing, you know, how deadly it can actually be.
Yeah, it definitely was. The loss of my brother was a huge a moment, life changer for me. And I spent a long time trying to help him get sober. I sent him to countless rehabs. I tried to be there to help him. And when I lost him, this show came, Mom came along 2 years after. And I thought, this is good. I feel like I am qualified to be in this world. I've gone to many Al-Anon meetings, many open AA meetings. I've been to rehab places with my brother. I just know that world. I had to go through it a lot, and I felt like I wanted to be a part. And I didn't feel that there was anyone was making fun of this process at all. I thought it was it was time to show a family struggling with this, because it just seems like these days everybody is struggling with being, you know, recovering from something. And I wanted to be part of that. I want to show what that's like.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alison Janney. So I think a lot of people first got to know you as CJ, the press secretary on The West Wing. Let's hear a scene from that. And this is a scene, President Bartlett had MS, but he was not telling people about it. And in this scene, Oliver Platt, who plays the White House counsel, has learned that the president has MS and has been keeping it from the public. And he's trying to figure out who on the White House staff knew and has been helping in the cover-up and who didn't. So here he is questioning you about whether you participated in covering up that information.
Okay.
Have you ever lied about the president's health?
Should I have my lawyer here?
I'm your lawyer.
You're the president's lawyer.
I'm the White House counsel, CJ. Have you ever lied about the president's health?
When did he tell you?
I'm sorry?
When did the president tell you?
6 days ago.
And Josh?
2 days after that.
Toby?
2 days before he told me. CJ, have you ever lied about the president's health?
And Leo, he told more than a year ago.
Yeah.
And I've had this for 6 hours now, so maybe giving me some room wouldn't be totally out of line. You know what I'm saying, Oliver?
CJ, I'm gonna have to ask you some questions. The less you can be pissed at the world for no particular reason, the better, I think.
I don't know you.
I'm sorry?
I was told to report to you. I don't know you. You've been here, what?
3 months.
3 months. So
yeah.
Why should I trust you?
Well, I don't care if you trust me or not.
Imagine my shock.
I got better things to do with my imagination.
I think this is going really well so far, Oliver. It's almost hard to believe that 4 different women have sued you for divorce.
Well, you can do that if you want, CJ. I've been through it a couple times with Josh and Toby, but sooner or later you're going to have to answer questions.
Either to you or...
A grand jury.
Compelled by...
A Justice Department subpoena.
Well, I have to tell you, it'll be the first time I've been asked out in quite a while, so...
It's entirely possible that the president has committed multiple counts of a federal crime to which you were an accomplice.
That much has sunk in the last 6 hours.
Has it?
Yes.
So why don't you knock off the cutie pie crap and answer the damn question?
What was the question?
Have you ever lied about the president's health? What is your answer?
Many, many times.
Ooh, CJ's in trouble.
It's my guest, Alison Janney, with Oliver Platt in a scene from The West Wing. So I always wonder, when you do that kind of snappy retort type of Aaron Sorkin dialogue, does it improve your ability to have witty retorts in real life and to have razor-sharp dialogue when you're speaking extemporaneously?
Oh, Terry, would that were true. No. Unfortunately, that was the biggest disappointment, that just didn't just, you know, seep into my skin and my brain, and I was able to just speak like Aaron Sorkin writes the minute I left that show. But no, I can't, I don't have that. I don't have that razor wit that CJ had. Politics scared the crap out of me because I did not grow up in a family where we talked about anything really, but, you know, pass the peas and do this. And, you know, we didn't really have political discussions at the dinner table. I didn't learn how to, you know, watch or, you know, listen to politics, and then to have to step into this world and really be an actress and really be playing someone that I had no idea what I was talking about half the time. And I have to, you know, I'd study my lines and read and like going, what the hell am I talking about? What, I learned a great deal doing that show and I loved it, but I felt just really fish out of water when we'd go to Washington and be, you know, go out to dinner. I'd meet the, you know, the former press secretaries and you know, to be sitting around with Dee Dee Myers and Joe Lockhart and talking. I just would just get so nervous. I wouldn't know what to ask them. So I felt a real pretender to the throne.
Allison Janney will be back in the second half of the show. She's nominated for 2 Emmys, one for her performance in Masters of Sex, the other for the sitcom Mom. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Bloomington. SPIA is committed to preparing leaders and advancing knowledge for the greater good. From Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort, offering European cruises on Viking longships. More at vrc.com/radio. And from Berkeley, publisher of Sue Grafton's W is for Wasted, the new Kinsey Millhone thriller. Available now in paperback, wherever books are sold. This is NPR.
Coming up, Allison Janney talks about the accident that ended her dream of becoming a figure skater. TV critic David Bianculli talks about new interactive TV shows that let you vote on contestants and their old low-tech predecessors. He'll take us back to the days of the clap-o-meter. And Ken Tucker reviews Spoon's new album, They Want My Soul. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Allison Janney. She's nominated for 2 Emmys, Outstanding Guest Actress in a Drama Series for her performance in Showtime's Masters of Sex, and Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series for her performance in CBS's Mom. The Emmy ceremony is August 25th. Janney won 4 Emmys for her role in The West Wing as White House Press Secretary C.J. Craig. She's also been in a lot of movies, including Primary Colors, American Beauty, Juno, and The Help. I want to play what was a very small part in an independent film called Margaret, which was written and directed by Kenneth Lonergan. Mm-hmm. And your performance in this is really incredible, even though it's so short. And mm-hmm. So here's the scene. The main character in this is played by Anna Paquin. She's a teenager who... September 11th has just happened. She really is very confused. She's kind of experimenting with her own sexual kind of power. And she's been flirting with a bus driver as a bus drives by. And because he's distracted by her, he ends up going through a light and hitting you. You're a mm-hmm. pedestrian. Mm-hmm. And the Anna Paquin character is so upset at what's happened. She runs over and finds you lying on the ground. One of your legs is actually under the bus, like kind of mm-hmm. amputated under the bus. And she's trying to help you, and here is the scene.
Call an ambulance. Everybody just step back.
I'm calling one right now.
Get an ambulance.
Someone's calling one.
Ma'am, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I don't know. Where am I?
You're on Broadway and 75th
Broadway
Street.
Between 75th and 74th Street.
Who are you? My name is Lisa.
What do you mean? Am I dead?
No, you're not dead. You're in a traffic accident, but you're going to be okay.
I don't have a direct address. She's out in the street. What do you mean? What happened?
You were run over by a bus.
You've got to be kidding me. A bus?
Yeah.
Is there a doctor?
So where am I now?
Anywhere.
An ambulance is on its way.
Still
happening?
No, I mean, yes, the accident's over, but I think you're a little confused.
I'll say I'm confused.
Here, let me try to see if
no!
I can.
Don't let go of me!
That's such a riveting scene. And, you know, I when I was growing up, there were a few blocks that didn't have stoplights or traffic lights, and that had a lot of car accidents. And car accidents, the sound of those cars crashing mm. when I was young yeah. is still in my mind and still yeah, just terrifying sound. To me. I'm wondering if you kind of drew on stuff like that in this role, just the kind of horror of like one of the most dreaded things as a pedestrian.
I didn't know how I was going to play that scene, and I really depended on Kenny Lonergan. He really gave me some good things to think about or be to play. Like he would say, "Oh, be angry now," or be the, like just to just show the complete what it must be like to be in having been hit by a bus and not feel like it, but just be incredibly confused and not worry. All I knew is that I was covered in blood, this, you know, stage blood, out on 75th and Broadway in front of Citarella's. I was there on the street in blood for the whole day. I just sort of lived in the life of just being there in that blood. It was one of the weirdest scenes to film, and it wasn't like any other scene I've ever played because it wasn't like... I don't know. I was doing so many different things in it.
Well, you know, you said that Kenneth Lonergan kept feeding you like direction, like do it, yeah. do it angry. And you could have done the same lines in a just a kind of confused, questioning way. Like instead of
yeah.
being that kind of angry, controlling, like, what do you mean a bus?
Yeah.
It could have been like, what do you mean a bus?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So, but I felt that doing it that kind of like angry, controlling, tough New Yorker
yeah.
way
yeah.
told so
yeah.
much about your character, even though yeah. this is all we see of you, because you die in that scene.
Yeah, that's it. I knew. I mean, it was funny when Kenny asked me to do it. I was in L.A. and he said, I know this is, and by the way, you know, we filmed that in like, I felt like we filmed that in 2002 or 2003, and I don't think it came out until last year. I mean, it was a long time before it came out. It's one of the, it's just an amazing masterpiece he did with that movie. I think it's, I'm so proud that I'm a part of it. But when he asked me to be in it and I read the scene, I was like, well, at least I know I won't get cut. You know, I knew it was going to be in the movie because it was, you know, what the whole movie moves forward because of that moment there. So, but it was interesting and I really am grateful for his help.
So when you were young, when you were a teenager, I think you didn't want to be an actor. You were thinking more about being a figure skater.
Yes.
But then you had a really bad accident and injured your leg. What happened?
I was 17, and I was at a party that my friends and my parents were throwing. It was an outdoor party, and there were these sliding doors, some of them open, some of them closed, right by the band. And I hit one of the windows, and it was in sort of the lower part of my body. My right leg went through. And then the glass kind of guillotined my right leg, and I was so embarrassed that I had hit the glass. I didn't know that had happened. I turned to the band who had stopped playing, and I was like, play, just keep playing, keep playing, keep playing. I was so embarrassed. And then I turned around and looked at everyone just like staring at me, and I was like, uh-oh. It was like a Fellini movie with all these people's faces popping in over my head and looking at me with, you know, cigarettes. And my older brother came in to, you know, someone was trying to put a tourniquet around my leg, and he shoved them aside and held my leg up over my heart to keep the, you know, so I could keep my leg. And I mean, I may be going into too much detail.
Was your leg almost, was it at risk of amputation?
Yeah. I mean, I lost, well, first of all, I lost like 3/4 of my blood. I lost an artery and cut tendon. And I was in the hospital for like seven, 8 weeks. I missed my first year of college. And after that, of course, I didn't skate for a very long time. Changed a lot of things about my life and sort of made me a little more fearful, I think, unfortunately. Just afraid of mortality and losing, things happening, you know.
How did that figure, if at all, into your decision to act?
Well, it definitely took out the possibility of being a skater, and I wasn't that good anyway. I was graceful, but I'm too big. It's such an athletic sport, and I was very graceful, and I could have been a nice dancer maybe, but that went away, you know, and then I had to take a year off because I had to recover and had all these skin grafts and things I had to go through, and then I went to Kenyon College, which is where I hooked up with them. You know, my freshman year, Paul Newman, who went to Kenyon, came to direct the brand new theater they had built there, and he came to christen it by directing the first play, and I managed to get in that, and then that sort of started the acting ball rolling.
How tall are you?
I am, you know, I say 5'12". Ha ha. I'm definitely 6 feet, and my heels, I'm six three. Yeah.
Now, how did that affect you as a teenager, and how did it affect you as a young actress when you were getting started?
Well, it was all, you know, I went to a school with, like, you know, first through 12th grades, under 300 kids, this school called Miami Valley School in Dayton, Ohio, and I was just, you know, so tall. And it wasn't until I went to college, to Kenyon College, that I, you know, started having my first date. So I was a sort of a late bloomer in a lot of things, and I always felt that way, and I feel like my career started late, and I think it was because of my height and maybe some of my confidence issues, but I you know, was playing 40-year-old women when I was 20, when I was, you know, and I just, I didn't get considered for ingenue roles, or I just wasn't, I don't know, maybe I just wasn't ready, or things started happening when I turned 38, I started to have a career. So, you know, I think my height probably did have something to do with it, but it's also helped me in certain parts. I think it's made me definitely more of a character actress in terms of my love of doing comedy or being, you know, I get cast as either the smartest woman in the room or the drunkest woman in the room. Those are the two. A lot of stuff in between, but I do well in getting those kind of parts, authoritative or completely crazy. Which I love. I love both of those kinds of roles.
Well, now you're nominated for 2 Emmys, and that must be pretty great to have that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really proud of both of these nominations because the projects are both, they're just so different, and I got really lucky to be able to show myself as in these two very different women at the same time.
Well, I wish you good luck with
Terry,
with
thank
the
you.
Emmys. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Allison Janney is nominated for 2 Emmys, one for her performance in Showtime's Masters of Sex, the other for her performance in CBS's sitcom Mom. The Emmy ceremony is August 25th. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli looks back on the early history of interactive TV talent shows and returns to the days of the clap-o-meter. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The more complex our personal technology gets, the more eager television is to take advantage of it. In the case of interactive TV, that now means the ability to vote on contestants and otherwise affect the outcome of what transpires, often in real time. But as our TV critic David Bianculli notes, this new interactive wrinkle actually is as old as television itself. In fact, even older.
And voting couldn't be easier. With a simple swipe, blue for yes or red for no, these performers' dreams are in your hands.
Rising Star, which premiered this summer on ABC, is the latest singing competition series in primetime. It takes advantage of smartphone technology by offering viewers a special app with which they can vote in real time. And it sounds spiffy and new, a high-tech upgrade of the voting methods of shows like The Voice and America's Got Talent, and the granddaddy of them all, American Idol, which relied on interactive phoned-in votes from viewers to declare its first winner a dozen years ago, as announced by then-co-host and now-host Ryan Seacrest.
The winner of American Idol 2002 is... Kelly Clarkson.
But these modern shows that conduct their talent auditions in private or allow judges to cast heavily weighted votes during early rounds aren't really as interactive as they could be, or as they once were. The interactive talent show, it turns out, predates TV itself. In 1935, a local New York radio show went national, first on NBC, then on CBS, and offered listeners a chance to both phone in and write to determine the fate of its eager contestants. The program was called the Major Bowes Amateur Hour, and it quickly became one of the most popular radio shows of the 30s and 40s. That first year, in 1935, the show spotlighted four young men, one of whom was a 19-year-old kid named Frank Sinatra.
We have now the Hoboken Four. They call themselves the Singing and Dancing Fools.
Who will speak for the group?
I will. I'm Frank. We're looking for jobs. How about it?
How about it indeed? Before long, Sinatra didn't have to beg to get work. An amateur hour kept finding other talent, including a 10-year-old singer named Beverly Sills. In 1946, Major Bowes died, but his musical director, Ted Mack, transplanted the show's legacy to television in 1947, where Ted Mack's amateur hour became the first genuine hit on that new medium, even before Milton Berle. And TV's amateur hour was interactive from the start.
Well, I just wouldn't be fair if I started counting the votes that are coming in. I'll tell you all about it next week. As I say, they've all tried awfully hard. As far as you folks here in the theater are concerned, I want to thank you for encouraging them. You folks out there, well, you know how we feel about the amateurs. We want very much for you to support them with your votes. Let me repeat it once more, because we do have a new telephone number. It's Plaza 74100 here in New York. We have all of the pet milk operators up there waiting for them right now, and they'll be on duty for another half hour. So you can get your
another type of early interactive TV, also coming from radio, was Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, a top-rated show that began on CBS Radio in 1946, moved to CBS Television in 1948, the first year CBS TV began operating, and lasted a full 10 years. Tony Bennett and Rosemary Clooney were among the acts that broke out on this show, which measured the applause of the studio audience to crown its weekly winners. Arthur Godfrey, the host, relied on a machine called the clapometer to gauge the response to each contestant.
Okay, thank you. And the violinist, Joseph Bernstein. Joy Carroll.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know.
And Ingeborg Nordquist, the soprano.
No, be where you find it. Don't be blind. It's all around you everywhere.
There's no mistake about that one. The audience reaction indicator shows the winner tonight to be Ingeborg Nordquist.
The same clap-o-meter gimmick was used on Queen for a Day, another TV show that made a successful transition from radio in the 40s. The horrible premise of this popular show was that women came on to compete for specific prizes of their choosing. But the winner was the woman whose life was deemed by audience applause vote to be the most pathetic. Here's host Jack Bailey interviewing one typical contestant.
How about children?
I have two.
Good for you. How old are they?
13 and 5.
Well, that's just wonderful. Now, Ms. Burke, I think your wish had something to do with one of the children, or both.
Yes. Huh? My boy.
Yeah, what's his name?
John Vernon.
Old John? What's the matter with old John?
Well, he's crippled up with cerebral palsy.
Is that so?
Yes,
sir. And he's now how old? 13?
13.
Yeah, he's had it quite a while. How can we help John?
Well, he needs a wheelchair and he needs a special bike for exercising.
Yeah. Had you promised him this by any chance?
Yes, I had.
Well, why didn't you keep your promises, Ma?
Well, I had to go to the hospital and have my legs operated on and had to quit working.
What were you doing?
Waitress work.
Oh, boy. 25 years, and that did it to your leg.
It sure did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now you have to take it a little easier yourself.
Well, I can't work. I'd sure keep my promise.
Well, bet you would keep your promise. Now, he's a 13-year-old boy, then he wants... Do you want a sort of a special bike?
Well, he needs it for exercising his legs. He's had quite a lot of surgery done, and...
Yeah. Viva Birch, if you're our queen, we're going to get a wheelchair and a special bike, okay?
Thank you.
She won that week, which means she not only got her wish, but on TV, she was given a crown, a robe, and a royal fanfare.
I crown you Queen Viva! Queen for a day! Queen Viva Birch! Now, Your Majesty, you just take your place up there on the throne. Here comes the Duchess with your first gift, the Queen's bouquet of 4 dozen brilliant coronation red roses from our royal florist.
The clapometer was interactive in spirit, but not always in practice, where the dials often were manipulated by a crew member to rig the results. Finally, there was one other example of interactive TV from the early days of television. It was a CBS children's cartoon show from 1953, featuring a live-action host and a high-tech gimmick. The host was Jack Barry. The show was Winky Dink and You. And the gimmick was that young viewers were encouraged to get their parents to send away for a Winky Dink viewing kit, which included erasable crayons, a cloth, and a sheet of plastic to put over your TV set to draw things when you were instructed. In this episode of Dusty Dan Goes to Hollywood, for example, the cartoon character of Dan peeks through a hole in a wooden fence and witnesses a robbery taking place. He seeks help from the TV host, Jack Barry, who, in turn, seeks help from kids at home with their Winky Dink kits.
I'm giving you exactly 1 minute to turn over the rest of your money. I know you have more than this.
1 minute? Boys and girls, I've got an idea. Dan can't find something to throw over that fence. Whoever has the yellow Winky Dink crayon at home, stand by. You're going to draw right with your Winky Dink kits and draw that rock. Use your yellow Winky Dink crayon. Draw a round circle in Dan's hand. Just a round circle. Make it any size you want. Doesn't matter how well you draw it, as long as you complete it as soon as possible. Only 1 minute and time is flying by. Use your yellow Winky Dink crayon from your Winky Dink kit.
The troubling thing about Winky Dink and You was that whether you drew anything or not, Winky and his friends still went on about their business. And today's interactive TV shows work the same way. Even if you don't cast any votes for American Idol or Rising Star, there will always be a winner, until the show itself is canceled. Which, of course, is the ultimate exercise in interactive television. You can vote by not watching.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Spoon. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Spoon's new album called They Want My Soul. It's the group's first record since Transference in 2010. The band, which began in Austin, Texas, has achieved both critical and commercial success. Its songs are used extensively as mood music by TV producers and have been heard in such shows as The Simpsons, House, Bones, How I Met Your Mother, and the Showtime series Shameless. Here's Ken's review.
Will you call me your baby? You hurt me, I just don't understand. Well, you say that you need me like the ocean needs sand, but the way you mistreat me, I just don't understand. Well, you know that I love you.
I'd say that that song, I Just Don't Understand, is a classic Spoon song full of raw romantic disappointment and frustration set to a catchy beat, except for one thing. It's not a Spoon song. It's a cover of a 1961 single recorded by the actress Anne Margaret, back when sex kittens cut pop songs for fun and profit. Yet in another way, it's a perfect example of what Spoon does. The band has impeccable taste in material to cover, as well as being able to invest almost any song with a certain kind of urgency that's immediately recognizable. On which singer-guitarist-songwriter Britt Daniel allows his trademark hoarse, ragged vocal to get pushed around by slamming drums and slashed guitar chords. The title phrase is meant to be understood as the price one pays for trying to live with someone. And speaking of slashed sounds, listen to the squawky rave-up that occurs midway through another song, Knock, Knock, Knock. It deploys distortion to mimic the effect of a manic state of mind.
You said you were living in a buttoned up world, living in 1892. I know what nothing they could say to convince me, or to blame nobody but you.
The lyrics on this album are assiduously elliptical, standard operating procedure for Spoon. There's a joke or two tucked in here and there, as when, on the song Outlier, Daniel sings, "You walked out on Garden State, 'cause you had taste." And I'm betting he's referring to the 2004 Zach Braff movie rather than the state of New Jersey itself. Still, most of the time, the words give up few clear meanings other than puzzlement over the ways of romance that the music is invariably more effective at illustrating.
I thought
They Want My Soul is another fine Spoon album in a career that has now come to display a remarkable consistency, which for some listeners will signify as more of the same thing. But keep listening, and beyond the usual twisting melodies and Britt Daniels' disarming melancholy, They Want My Soul reveals one possible meaning of its title. There's a soulfulness here that anyone would envy, would want with all one's heart.
Ken Tucker reviewed Spoon's new album, They Want My Soul. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Auction off what you love. It will come back sometime.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from DreamWorks Pictures, Steven Spielberg, and Oprah Winfrey, with The 100-Foot Journey starring Helen Mirren, directed by Lasse Hallström, in theaters Friday. From Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. And from Angie's List, where consumers can browse, buy, and schedule local services online. More at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, historian Rick Perlstein, the author of Nixonland, talks about his new book in his series on the rise of American conservatism. It's called An Invisible Bridge, and it explains the rise of Ronald Reagan amid the turbulent events of the mid-70s, from Watergate and the fall of Saigon to gas lines and the Symbionese Liberation Army. Join us.